Good morning. Welcome to Mac Chat. I'm Hugh Tewett, and your co-host today is Rachel Cartland. Good morning to you, Rachel.
Good morning, Hugh. It's great to be back with you and see you behind the desk in your proper place.
Thank you very much indeed. Okay, we're talking today about the middle class and the government. 70% of respondents to a survey about the policy address agreed that the views of the middle class were being ignored in that. The CE has said that he hasn't forgotten the middle class, stressing that the initiatives proposed in, for example, education, land, housing and medical services had responded to their aspirations. And WK Lamb, the convener of Exco, has said the increase in housing supply proposed was targeted at the middle class to help them afford to purchase their homes. So are they really missing out, or are the big bucks going towards welfare for the grassroots? What do you make of the apparent split between the financial secretary and the chief executive on government spending? Are we in real danger of simply running out of cash? Give us a call with your thoughts. Our number 233 88266. 233 88266. Email backchat at rthk.hk or go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3, and comment there. After 9.15, we're talking about editorial battles at Ming Pao. With us for the first discussion, we have Sin Jun Kai, legislator with the Democratic Party, Marcellus Wong, who's a former president of the Taxation Institute of Hong Kong, David Webb, founder of website.com, a shareholder activist, and Kenneth Leung, who's a legislator who represents the accountancy functional constituency. Good morning to you all, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us today. Where to start? Maybe with David Webb. Nice to speak to you again.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Do you think the middle class are missing out?
They're not missing out, but they do suffer from inept government policy in taxation and fiscal planning. I think that the recent remarks of John Tsang in relation to the money all running out if we keep untargeted spending going are rank hypocrisy, because of all the financial secretaries, he is the one who has thrown money around in the most indiscriminate way in all of his previous budgets. $37 billion.
It could be hypocritical, it could still be true. Do you think it's still true?
Well, perhaps he wasn't writing the budget then, but he certainly delivered them. There are many things that are unnecessary in our current spending. For example, there was that one-off $37 billion for the $6,000 per person handout. There is an ongoing scheme to dump $4.5 billion into electricity accounts every year for every rich person in Hong Kong like me and every poor one. Now, if we just gave money to people who needed it, we could spend less and do more for them at the same time. On the transport system, he now subsidizes the transport fares for everybody over 65, not just those on CSSA, people, when, in 17 years' time, I will get the benefit of that subsidy. The government will start paying my transport costs. And if you look at, for example, the electricity money, $4.5 billion a year, over the next 20 years, that'll be $90 billion. So when he bleats about our $1,500 billion of reserves being bled away in these schemes, he's the one that's responsible for it.
So he shouldn't be giving money to the middle class because they don't need it.
What he needs to do for the middle class is ensure ample opportunity, fair taxation. And we don't have fair taxation right now. We have stupid schemes like the tax on housing benefits, which is only 10% of your cash salary rather than what the housing is really worth. We have a 17% incremental tax rate until you reach a plateau when you go down to 15, and that's just nonsense. The only tax system in the world that goes up and then down as you get to higher incomes. What we need is a flat tax there. I know that the Institute of Taxation has suggested just expanding the allowances, but there's a much more sensible thing that we could do, which is to raise the allowance by about $60,000 and then implement a flat rate of tax at 14 or 15% for everything above that. And that would eliminate all of the head-scratching that couples have to do when deciding whether to elect for joint taxation or separate taxation. It would provide a uniform rate of tax, and we could probably apply a lower rate of tax if we taxed the housing benefits properly, so that civil servants weren't just enjoying much lower effective rates of taxation than many others. there are other areas where revenues should be raised. There's no duty on diesel, for example, despite our appalling air pollution. In a sop to the transport trade, the government has reduced diesel duty to nothing over years. There's no congestion pricing for the busiest times of day on our busiest roads, and there should be, so that we can ration that resource properly. So then they are hitting the middle class, and this is where they're suffering, on stamp duty. You have to now live in Hong Kong for at least 7 years, despite the recent Court of Final Appeal ruling on social welfare. You have to live here 7 years before you can buy a property without paying 15% buyer's stamp duty, if that law gets passed. And by the way, it's still sitting in the Legislative Council, and they are filibustering it quite correctly. And then you have to pay double stamp duty unless you're a permanent resident with no existing home, which could amount to 8.5%. And if you're an SME, a middle-class person trying to start a small business, and you want to buy an office property, again, you'll have to pay 8.5% double stamp duty, and if that law is passed, which it still hasn't been. So, there are a number of tax policies that I would change to make the system fairer to the middle class without dishing out money to them. They certainly don't need that. What they need is a fair chance.
I'm closer to free bus rides than David, actually, a bit. And so my memory goes back a bit further, and so I can remember the mighty budget speeches in the long ago days of Sir Philip Haddon-Cave, which were indeed kind of exegesis on a whole underpinning economic and fiscal theory, which perhaps seems to be missing now. We don't have a very clear sense of what the theory is. And I guess we've been hearing recently from some accountants and so on that they, like David, would like to change the tax system, but perhaps really quite drastically, bringing in GST and so on. So I wondered what Marcellus and Kenneth felt about that. Would they like to see a total revamp of tax?
Maybe Marcellus first, because you have come up with a number of proposals, haven't you, including GST, I think, and the increasing the threshold, which David mentioned.
Let me first respond to some of David's comments, which I agree with him on the majority of all the comments. I mean, like, the taxation issue also do not agree with the government's of handing our cash indiscriminately to all residents. All those comments are fair. And we also suggest, the current tax system now has been in place for over just 40 or 50 years without any comprehensive review. We do recommend a comprehensive review of the whole taxation system to take into consideration of a fairer system, as David commented, and also how to address the long-term fiscal sustainability for Hong Kong, I mean, including the problem with the aging population. So the institute, apart from recommending some relief for the middle class, like expanding the tax bans, and also helping them for the deductions of medical insurance, dependent parent allowance, as well as other relief measures, but not to give out cash or subsidize electricity bills, which everybody's like, even Li Ka-shing, we say, also benefits from it. Regarding stamp duty, I think I'll leave it to Kenneth, because Kenneth is now debating this bill in the Legislative Council.
Yeah, for the two stamp duty bills, the first one about the buyer stamp duty, I think there are a lot of filibustering, and I don't know when actually this bill will get passed. And for the double stamp duty, I entirely agree with David, because for SMEs, if you buy a property in Hong Kong, you are going to pay 8.5%. And I'm going to put through a committee stage amendment to give relief to enterprises, business who which, you know, they're going to, if they get the first property in Hong Kong, if they're going to use it for their own business operation, I think they should get exemption. And commenting on John Zhang's, you know, measures, of course, I think you can look at John Zhang's, you know, when before CY became the chief executive, before that, yes, he's been doing something quite stupid, indiscriminately dishing out cash to everyone. But after CY became the CE, I think the latitude, the scope of his budget become very, very limited. In fact, he was just, you know, counting the beats for CY's, you know, policy. And in fact, I don't think he got a lot to maneuver. Of course, I mean,
do you think he has different ideas to the...
Well, perhaps I can read into his mind. Perhaps he has different ideas. But at least he has to implement all CY's poverty alleviation policy, all his policy on education and medical. And of course, there are a lot of, you know, middle-class people who have got some aspiration on what is he going to do with the middle class. But honestly, I think the middle class don't need a lot of things. They need just want a fair, competitive economy, opportunities to do well. And of course, we are concerned about high property price. And of course, these two so-called stamp duty measures are supposed to be demand management tools to, you know, suppress the property price in the long run. But how effective they are after they become implemented is very, very doubtful.
That's a complete misunderstanding of economics on the government's part. Mm. What those measures have done is not to suppress demand, but to suppress supply as well, because they widen the gap between buyers and sellers and suppress volume. It hasn't affected valuations. Those are affected by other things such as interest rates, and they are now starting to go upwards. In the US, the long-term bond rate has gone up significantly in the last year. So those are factors that affect property prices, not crushing the transaction market and putting estate agents out of business. Now, I've got no sympathy for estate agents generally, but they do deserve to make a living, and they shouldn't be impeded by government taxation.
It does seem extraordinary, doesn't it, that currently there's almost no movement at all. I know I have friends who would be like to sell their property, and they're perfectly legitimate sellers, but they just feel they can't do it because there are no buyers around.
If they're fortunate enough to have bought their property through a company, preferably a BVI one, then as half of such properties over $20 million are in fact owned by companies, residential properties, then they can sell the company. So there is an underground market in transferring companies going on, because when the stamp duty is so prohibitive, it's worth taking a little bit of risk by buying a company which may have some unresolved liabilities rather than buying the property itself.
Mm. Mm. Okay.
I do have a general comment.
Sun Jun Kai, go ahead.
Yeah, I do have a general comment. You know, the approval rate, the acceptance or the approval rating of the policy address dropped substantially, a day and, in the subsequent polls. The initial reactions seems to be quite welcoming of the policy address, but the subsequent poll revealed that the support of the policy address dropped tremendously. Dropped 11%. I think people start to, you know, realize the outcomes or the long-term impact of the financial burden of all the initiatives. And I believe the middle class raise their worries whether, you know, in long-term run, they have to sacrifice or they have to have a higher burden, for example, by higher taxes. So I think because of that, you know, the support of the policy address drops substantially. I do believe that the financial secretary, you know, instead of writing blogs in his website, I think he should come out and, you know, have a more realistic or a more substantial forecast of the impact of these initiatives. And I understand the government has a future, they have an internal working group, you know, studying on the impact of the,
You're talking about the long-term planning committee. I think that was a short-term, long-term. Hasn't it been abolished already?
No.
They've just done their job.
Last year. And then I do believe that, Johnson should actually come out as early as they can, you know, what sort of, this is not about the budget, but yeah, I think this is about the policy address, you know, how the policy address has a long-term impact on the public finance. I think the public deserve a substantial explanations. You know, it is not quite real that, you know, financial secretary, you know, secretary for treasury and the chief executive, they have different line to take on these important issues. You know, what is the is it 10 billion, is it 12 billion, is it 20 billion, you know, while the Secretary for Treasury have a middle role, you know, saying, you know, 15 billion around that. I think the government usually, they do have a consensus before they put forward any policy.
I think probably what has driven down support is his latest, John Chang's latest comments on his blog, to do his best to generate a surplus for the remainder of his term. Of all things, that's not what we need.
Yes, Mr. Sen, I mean, coincidentally, I'm sitting on the working group of the government's long-term fiscal planning. And responding to Mr. Sin's comments, I'm sure John Chang will announce and bring all this issue on the table on the 26th of February, financial budget speech, because we have already submitted the report to him. And he's updating those numbers with the implication of the policy speech.
I mean, what he really needed, though, was not a short-term, long-term planning committee, which has now done its report and finished. He needs a standing committee of the type that the US president has, a Council of Economic Advisers, to continuously advise on fiscal policy rather than just this one-off thing, which the report, I'm sure you worked very hard on it, but basically you ended up with vague recommendations about the need to review the possibility of GST in the future because there's a couple of very strong
advocates for it. There's only a small part of it.
And other things. and general hand-wringing about the future expenses. Now, one of the mistakes that the government repeatedly makes when it looks at the so-called old age problem is to take static figures from the current and situation and project them into the future without amendment. That's inappropriate because although we are going to have more and more people over the age of 65, the claims rate from them on CSSA has flatlined for the last 7 or 8 years at around 100,000 cases. And that's because people retiring tomorrow and the year after are going to have much higher lifetime savings and incomes behind them, and they won't need to fall back into the social safety net. So, in fact, the scale of this problem is not as large as the government would have you believe. Of the current old age population, 3/4 of them did not get beyond primary school. Of the future old age population, most of them will have a full secondary education.
Yeah, this is, of course, very true. I think we don't sometimes give sufficient weight to how dynamic the demographics of recent Hong Kong history have been. I guess the GST, the goods and service tax, VAT or whatever, is one of the things that people will be looking at most closely. And so this really seems to be a possibility, does it, Marcellus?
No, actually, I put forward a motion debate a few weeks ago in LegCo, and I only touched slightly on exploring a broadly based tax, including GST, and the initial feedback from all my colleagues in the last group is that no. But of course, I mean, we had a disastrous, you know, GST consultation back in 2005-06. But I think the mistake made by the government at that point was that they wanted a very simple tax system, and yet they wanted GST without giving consideration or exemption to the grassroots people, without exempting the basic necessities. And then at a very, very late stage, and Henry Tang say, oh, we're now considering, you know, exempting food and medical, you know, supplies and all that. But that was too late. If we are going to have a new broadly based tax system, then our tax system would not be as simple as it is now.
We don't need. It's a myth that our tax system is narrow. We do have profits tax that applies to anyone who makes a profit, and we have salaries tax that applies to anyone who makes a salary above an allowance for their living costs. It's a fact of life here because of immigration patterns over 50 years that only a small portion of the population does make enough money to pay that salaries tax.
But that is what it is. It doesn't mean the system is narrow. And if you start talking about sales taxes or value-added taxes, first of all, the GST, as it was proposed, was against the basic law because it ruined our freeport status, which is promised in the basic law. It would put a tax on anything that lands on the docks. A value-added tax would be consistent with the basic law, but it would simply amount to a gross tax on profits, and it would be regressive because poor people would have to pay it too. Even if you exempted some categories, they'd still end up paying some. And given that we have a profits tax, why take something off the top when we can take it off of the net line after rent and labour costs and so on?
Okay.
So I don't favour introducing a VAT. And in fact, we have a commitment in the budget, in the basic law, to maintain expenditure in line with GDP, and the government's already been breaching that by raising it from 18 to 21% since the handover.
Well, it's a broad, balanced budget. I mean,
no, there's also a commitment to keep expenditure in line with economic output. And
I think there's been, certainly in the past, there have been internal guidelines around about 20% of GDP.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was laid down by Hedingay's time and Bambridge's time. I think that there's still those guidelines, although it's not very much publicised these days. And of course, I mean, they need to finance, recurring expenditure by recurring revenue.
From Basic Law Article 107. Requires Hong Kong to strive to achieve a fiscal balance, that's part one, avoid deficits, that's part two, and keep the budget commensurate with the growth rate of its gross domestic product. And that means that we can't increase the percentage of gross domestic product without breaking the basic law. Mm. There's a practical reason as well, of course, that if we did jack up the size of government here to say 25 or 30%, then we would actually start eroding the taxable profits that pass through Hong Kong on their way out of China, because as long as we have a tax rate significantly lower than China's 25%, we will attract that profit base. If we start reaching it or exceeding it, a lot of what we think we can tax won't be here.
Okay, Sin Jun Kai, whose side are you on, a financial secretary or the chief executive?
I think we need to have a right balance, but at the moment, I think, what the chief executives have done, he responded to some of our requests. For example, widening the support of the OH, health, and also some of the measures. But I think the next is the financial secretary need to respond to the comment, and then to have a layout
But you said people were concerned. You said that the support for the policy address went down because people realised how much it was going to cost. Do you think that they were justified in that concern?
Well, I think the concern should be justified. I think the
but isn't he just spending in the way that you asked him to spend?
Well, I believe some of the measures that the policy address. It's actually a long-term request by some of our allies, and even by some of my party. So, the budget, I think later will actually reveal that some of the one-time measures, like the electricity payment by the government. I think that will be. That will have impact. What I mean is, because the government have already spent money for helping the poor, so the government has less money to spend for the general public.
But doesn't it sound a little bit that the poor government, damn whatever they do, they can't win? I mean, it is true that for many years now, I think very much across the board, people have been saying Hong Kong's got one of the world's worst Gini coefficients, its biggest problem is the rich-poor gap. And so the government tries to do something to alleviate that, and immediately the people are going to have to pay for that. Start squeaking. It's a bit odd, isn't it? How do you feel about that, Mr. Seen? Do you feel there's a little bit of whatever the government does is not going to be fairly looked at?
No. I think definitely. CY Leung is doing something quite differently from John Zhang, and in fact, I do have some sympathy for CY when he do something that in responding to some of the requests to help the poor. For many years, and now CY has done, and then John Zhang, in one way or the other rebut what the CY done. And
you're on CY's side.
Not entirely, but I think on the helping the poor, yes, you may say so, but on politics, no, definitely not.
No, I think what is concerned what concerns me about CY's poverty alleviation policies, that's a long-term commitment. Now, this is the second policy address. And what may come in the third policy or the fourth policy address is my concern as well, because after he had done so much, what is next and what is the year after?
That's the point, isn't it, David Webb? I mean, you were complaining about the $6,000 or the electricity allowance, but those are one-off payments, and they're not the same as recurrent.
It's become so frequent in it's every budget we have a one-off electricity subsidy that there's building up an public expectation that this thing will continue.
How many have we had? Five
about 10,
or something?
About no, it's been going 10? On since Donald Zang's time, and you know that ought to end, and we ought to be paying the horrendous cost that we do pay to the power monopolies for electricity. But the scheme of control is another issue.
But that can end, and the $6,000 certainly did end. And
was a one-off.
Yeah, no one would consider doing that again. But it's very hard to go back on these allowances, and it's hard even to keep the allowances stable because they will drift upwards.
Unfortunately, I mean, there's a patchwork of these allowances. This is the other problem. First, we have the work incentive transport scheme, and now we have the latest scheme. I can't remember the acronym for that one, but there ought to be a more holistic approach to welfare. We can all agree on the principle that everyone should have a basic cost of living provided to them if they aren't capable of earning it themselves or aren't earning it themselves, and that we don't want to remove the work incentive from that process, so there must still be a higher income available.
Sorry, I asked you a question. I'm going to have to cut you off now in your answer, but you can return to it in 3 minutes' time after the news. The weather quickly before that, it's going to be fine today. Cold this morning, dry during the day, becoming cloudier with temperatures rising later in the week. 12 degrees now, relative humidity is at 82%. Welcome back. This is Backchat on a Thursday morning with Rachel Cartland and me, Hugh Chiverton, continuing our discussion about the government expenditure, the apparent conflicts between the chief executive and the financial secretary, and the role of the middle class in all of this. We have with us in our central studio Kenneth Leung, who's the legislator who represents the accountancy functional constituency, David Webb, founder of website.com, a shareholder activist, Marcellus Wong, former president of the Taxation Institute of Hong Kong, and legislator Sin Jun Kai from the Democratic Party. You can email backchat at rthk.hk or go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. A couple of interesting comments on there. One from Craig on Lantau, which has some interesting ideas, which we'll get to in a moment. But just before the news, I was talking to David Webb and talking about the difference between the more or less one-off payments or the non-recurrent expenditures, which perhaps the financial secretary has done in the past, and the longer-term commitment, which seems to be implied by the new policy measures in the policy address. David Webb, you were saying?
I was saying that I don't think anyone would disagree with the principle of providing a social safety net at the same time as not removing the work incentive. So there has to be some additional reward for going out to work as opposed to staying at home and collecting welfare. And one of the moral hazards introduced by subsidising people who do work is lowering the cost for employers. That all that the government is doing is basically subsidising employers by paying people extra money on top of their salaries. So they've got to be very careful in that area. Our welfare system is affordable as long as it is a welfare system and not a handout system to everybody, including people like me, who don't need it. The other thing that the government has a problem with is profligate spending on uneconomic projects like the Zhuhai Bridge, like the $67 billion high-speed train to Shenzhen,
those aren't open-ended.
There's a series of these things which are bleeding away the reserves. You can make the mistake that Japan has made building bridges to nowhere, or even in the latest proposal, the East Lantau Metropolis, I think is an artificial island somewhere between Lantau and Hong Kong, to which we will need new bridges and which will involve vast amounts of reclamation. And the question mark is, why isn't there a proper economic impact assessment on these things? Why aren't we using our existing resources more efficiently? And the temptation to spend all this money is partly because we take all our land premiums, all the value of the land that we sell comes up front rather than in ground rents, except for 3% of the rateable value, which is charged in ground rent. So we have these massive premiums up front that only a few developers can afford, leading to a cartel in the developer sector. And we've given away our tomorrow. We don't get the revenue that we could have if we had higher ground rents and lower premiums on land sales. And as that money piles up in the reserves, it gets allocated to what's called the Capital Works Reserve Fund, which the government feels obliged to spend on infrastructure, some of which we don't need. So there needs to be a rethink on smoothing out that revenue, raising ground rents so that we can build up a recurrent income stream from long leasehold property when we'll actually be needing it more in the future to support the changing demographics, and lessening the temptation to splurge on projects that we don't really need.
To go back to what you said right at the beginning when you were accusing the financial secretary of hypocrisy, you know, he would say he's not hypocritical because there are two different things. There's the one-off kind of spending, where you give out the $6,000 or whatever it is, and then there's longer-term commitments.
Well, either way, you're bleeding out cash. Cash is cash, and repeating these things again and again, such as rates, rebates, which happen nearly every year, electricity subsidies nearly every year. I mean, if you are actually taking in too much revenue, and that has been the case over the last 16 years, that the government has been running a structural surplus, then lower the tax rates. That's the best way to stimulate the economy, is to leave more money in people's pockets.
All right, on that topic, we come to the email bar from Craig. Thank you very much indeed, Craig. He has this is a letter to the FS. He says, this is a recent mail to the FS. Dear FS, having just settled my tax bill, I am once again financially hurting. I trust you realise life here is very hard and costly. Here are a couple ideas for the next budget. Idea one, tax rebates. Since we enjoy a surplus of funds and paying tax is a heavy burden for many people in Hong Kong, I have an idea. The government will rebate all tax paid by individuals over the past 5 years. However, rather than pay out in cash, the amount will be credited to our tax accounts as an amount on hand. Then subsequent tax demands would be settled against this. Of course, if someone's leaving Hong Kong or retiring, they can choose to have the rebate paid out to them directly. But for the majority, the money can be used to pay taxes for the next few years. This would be easy to administer and ensure the rebated funds were spent wisely rather than on the latest handbags or smartphones. Idea two, tax-deductible school fees. Let school fees be deductible. By this I mean that if I spend $100,000 on schooling, let me reduce my tax bill by $100,000. You should realise by sending a child to a non-government school, I'm freeing up spaces and reducing the financial burden to the government. However, I don't get any help from you on relief or relief for school fees. What do you think of these ideas, Mr. Jung? Asks Craig. What do you think of those ideas, Kenneth Leung?
Well, I think I do not agree with these deductions, because sometimes people will ask for deduction for rental, deduction for school fees, okay, deduction for private medical schemes, but of course there is a policy initiative there. Now, what we need is to lower the tax rate rather than having all these nitty-gritty, you know, deductions. And secondly, I want to comment on those capital projects which David Webb has just mentioned. It's not for the economic benefit which these white elephant projects were being constructed. These are political gestures, political commitments to the central government. It is not, you know, doesn't concern with the cost-benefit analysis at all.
Yes, is that and the construction sector.
And these projects are going to be more costly and costly. And
yeah, that's right,
there will be a huge track to the Hong Kong.
Now, look, on the education deduction, and there is a point, by the way, we should scrap the mortgage interest deduction. Why is it that people who rent don't get a deduction, but people who pay mortgages get a subsidy from the government? That doesn't make any sense. But on education, I think that's the greatest leveler in society, providing equal opportunity to all as far as we can. And rather than just have a deduction for school fees, which is a valid point, you're relieving the public of having to pay for one child's public school education, state schools. Instead, give every child a voucher and let's introduce competition into the schooling system, a voucher equal to the money that the government would spend on every student anyway, and let them take it anywhere they want so that the schools have to start firing their worst teachers to raise quality and compete for that voucher, because the voucher follows the child. both in the state system and in the private system. They can take it to a private school and pay a premium on top of that if they want. We can't really stop that in the free market. But they would also be able to shop around the other schools. And instead, the government is just fiddling around with this in kindergartens and not thinking about extending it to the full school system. And that would be a major improvement, I think, in the long run, in the quality of education in Hong Kong, because we'd suddenly see schools shaping up a bit more.
Sun Jun Kai,
on the education front, I think the government should actually increase the number of subsidized places in the universities. In the moment, the government only proposed to increase 1,000 connecting courses for the associated degrees. This is not sufficient. I believe that, they were quite far, I believe that the government should actually increase the number of, normal degree courses in Hong Kong. Instead of, just asking people to go to mainland China to study, they sponsor $15,000. And this is actually, unfair policies. People who send their children to Australia, to get nothing. People who send their children to United States get nothing, while the people send their children to mainland, they get $15,000. Why? I think, the government should actually focus more on our local educations.
Yeah. All this discussion is somehow bringing up this question of who are the middle classes? I mean, I certainly don't want to attack Craig. If he says he's hurting, I'm sure he is. But sometimes I hear people saying, I'm middle class and I'm hurting. And yet they actually have what, by other standards, would be fabulous lives. Children being educated overseas, live-in servants, which is almost unknown anywhere else, wonderful holidays, expensive flats. I wonder how our guests would define middle class. Where would they set the income levels?
As we know, John Chang is middle class.
Yes, indeed.
People drink
anyone who has a cup of coffee in the morning. So.
Or watch a French movie. They have
I think such discussions are really meaningless. There are income bands, if you want to define people that way, but what really matters is providing fairness and opportunity across the whole spectrum of incomes, and not engaging in envy taxes. I mean, why do we charge somebody 100% tax on a Ferrari that occupies the same road space as a Fiat made by the same company when they only pay 20% registration tax? Indeed, why do we charge registration tax at all? Because it's not owning a car that causes traffic problems, it's driving it that causes problems. So let's focus on congestion pricing and fuel taxes instead. We don't want envy taxes. We don't want hidden subsidies. For example, we should scrap the SME loan guarantee scheme, which just props up unviable businesses at taxpayers' expense and stifles the development of new businesses by not freeing up the labour that could go to them. We certainly need a social welfare scheme. We don't need a corporate welfare scheme. So that would save us, in the government's estimation, I think $11 billion, because when they guaranteed $100 billion of loans, they expect to lose $11. There needs to be a complete root and branch rethink, and the government does need a standing committee on taxation.
Kenneth Leung, in the middle class, property owners, basically, in Hong Kong.
Property owners, yes, they do suffer a lot. I mean, because of the high price of the down payment they made, and then the mortgage will, linger on for another 25 years. I think that there's no definition of middle class. Where it's only income bands, and if you own a property, then probably you are classified as a middle class in Hong Kong, as a general term. If you're not living in public housing and you're not on CSSA, then you are called a middle class. But there are various shades of middle class, and I think the people who suffer most is people who have a mortgage and who are not entitled to any of the social benefits, and of course they have to work very, very hard to pay off their mortgage, and that's life in Hong Kong.
Well, yes, they have to pay tax. People who pay tax, they believe they are middle class.
Yeah, and they have to pay tax.
Yeah.
Yeah, the tax bans here are quite high. So in a sense, you can say that almost anyone who's got an income like 90% that...
90% of salaries tax is paid by 10% of workers. Mm. So, as I suggested at the beginning of the programme, we could lift another chunk of people out of the tax system by having a flat tax, raise the allowance by about $60,000, and then tax everybody at the flat rate of 15 or 14% above that. And nobody would pay more under that system, and it would be simpler. And the 2% band and a 7% band on the first $80,000 of taxed income, it's an it's just not worth collecting that. It's 4.5% average. It's not worth it.
Okay, a comment on our Facebook page. This comes from Rod Non-Aggression, who says, if you look at indices from various organisations, you'll see that higher public spending does not correlate with an improvement in the living standards for the poor and middle class. Just because we rank first in economic freedom, we should not believe that we need to increase spending. Let's remember that when our government was even smaller 25 years ago, we had less inequality and more social upward mobility. And, of course, you eventually run out of money, as John Jung correctly points out.
Well, I think it was Thatcher who said the problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money to spend.
And I think, David, you were making a good point earlier about complexity of schemes or producing a patchwork of schemes. I mean, that doesn't help the administrators and it doesn't help the beneficiaries either.
Yes, I think, and I think one interesting thing that did come into the policy address was a proposal to have a one-stop shop on that and a unified means test, instead of all these different means tests that are scattered around the different schemes. I don't know quite how they would implement that, but there does need to be, again, a root and branch review of the legacy of all these schemes and to eliminate the redundant ones or the ones that overlap. Mm.
Yeah, I must say it's something I've been advocating for quite a long time. But interestingly, this new wage supplement apparently is going to be administered by the efficiency unit, which seems a very odd choice. I don't know, Kenneth or Sin Chung Kai, if you'll be picking that point up, because the efficiency unit is a very small number of people who are thinkers rather than implementers. That seems to me quite odd.
Maybe that's where the idea came from.
I think there are internal politics within the government. I think Rachel knows more than I do, but I believe I'll take up the issues.
Why is that? I mean, the reason given was to remove the stigma associated with receiving money from social welfare. Is that right?
Yeah, in a way, it is one of the malice that the wage subsidy is going to cure. But I think instead of looking at the very, basic CSSA to reform it, which I don't think the government has done anything in the past 5-10 years to have an overhaul of the CSSA. They are always inventing new schemes, as just been mentioned by David, so that all these patch-ups, I mean, just make the system so complicated, yes. And cost it to administer, and also for the beneficiaries to claim these benefits is so complicated.
I mean, it's basically sort of, if you can, in software terms, it's like running on Windows 95 with layer upon layer of patches when we actually need a new operating system there.
There's been speculation, of course, about the budget. Tsingtao, which quite often gets things fairly correct, well, used to anyway in the past, under Donald Jung.
I don't know whether good
things,
sources.
Things are different now, yeah. They say that the relief measures would be less than half of last year. They said the paper understood the government would not cancel rental waivers for public housing tenants, but the period would be cut. The amount of rates waivers would also be cut, but scrapping of electricity subsidy was still being considered. Tax rebates would be maintained, but the cap would not exceed $10,000, and the additional 1 month extra CSSA allowance.
I think the way to abolish these repeated handouts is to announce at the same, for public acceptability reasons, is to announce at the same time a reduction in the headline rate of salaries and profits tax, bring them into line, take them down to 13% or 14%, and at the same time say, and there won't be any tax rebates because it's fairer to charge a flat rate than to hand out rebates to individual people, because that usually skews the overall tax rate.
OK, well, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Thanks to Sin Jun Kai, legislator with the Democratic Party, Marcellus Wong, former president of the Taxation Institute, David Webb, shareholder activist, and the legislator who represents the accountancy functional constituency, Kenneth Leung. Thank you all very much indeed. We shall look ahead and see what actually happens in the budget, of course, coming up in about a month's time. It's 20 past nine.